This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. So who is the most influential person in Massachusetts state government? Governor Deval Patrick, Senate President Therese Murray, or House Speaker Robert DeLeo?
Any one of them, perhaps. They're all politically influential. But by another measure, that being the sheer number of dollars under your purview, the most influential person in state government just may be John Polonowicz.
Polonowicz is Massachusetts Secretary of Health and Human Services. His department is responsible for more than $21 billion in state programs, which amounts to more than half of the state's annual spending overall.
He's the man who oversees everything from the implementation of the state's new medical marijuana law to health care cost control efforts to mental health care, Medicaid spending, the state's compounding facilities, and the state crime lab. Virtually every branch of the Department of Health and Human Services has faced or still faces significant challenges and has done so even in the most recent months. We'll talk about several of them. And John Polonowicz was named to the post in January, and he joins us in the studio now. Secretary Polonowicz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. And I should say, it's not every state that can boast that its Secretary of Health and Human Services is a graduate of West Point, a Stanford MBA, has served in a Black Hawk assault helicopter company while also serving in the United States Army. So quite a resume. And we'll talk more about your background in a moment, but I just wanted to tease listeners with that is the man who's running HHS right now. But let's start off with the implementation of the state's medical marijuana law, because over the course of the summer, towards the end of the summer into September, I believe the timeline is such that some of the first applications can be put forward for the dispensaries that will be set up across Massachusetts. But obviously a lot of rules have to be finalized before that. So talk to me about some of the decisions that have been made. Like, if a person needed to be prescribed medical marijuana, would they be able to go to any doctor in Massachusetts, or would they have to go to specific physicians?
So one of the things that we've really tried to focus on, particularly around where individuals can go with their physicians, is the creation of a bona fide physician-patient relationship. And one of the reasons we did that is in looking at the other 17 states that have already implemented the medical marijuana laws. I think we frankly saw kind of the good and the not so good in terms of how those were enacted. One of the states has a scenario where I think 8 of the physicians, signed for 80% of the medical marijuana in that state. And, in our minds, and certainly the intent of the voters, was to ensure that this was done for palliative care, for pain issues. And the way that we believe that the way that has to be done is with a bona fide relationship with a physician. This is not someone who's just going to write a certification for you. This is somebody who knows what your medical history is, knows what debilitating condition you have, and that marijuana is an option for you.
And so regarding that state where a small number of doctors were issuing a majority of the prescriptions, or the prescriptions, just to get our facts straight, which state is that?
That'd be Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah,
okay.
as you could have imagined. So,
but
actually, it's not. To be clear, it's actually not a prescription, because marijuana is a Schedule I drug, and federal law actually prohibits you from writing a prescription for a Class I drug. So, in Schedule I. So it's actually we and many other states have chosen the terminology certification to give a certification for that, because it's not actually a prescription.
Okay. Now, what about quantities that can be administered or sold at any one time? I think I'm seeing that Massachusetts has decided to limit it to 10 ounces of marijuana every 60 days. But doctors can prescribe more, perhaps, if necessary. A lot of commenters on WBUR's health blog, Common Health, have said that seems like a lot, 10 ounces in 60 days.
So it's a great point. And, I will say, coming into the role in January, where the ballot initiative had already taken place, and we were actually in the midst of starting to promulgate the regulations, sounded like a lot to me, too. Washington says 24 ounces is an appropriate supply. So that's really significantly more than that. The thing that I was informed about, and I wasn't really aware of this, is that a number of individuals aren't actually smoking the marijuana. It's either used in baking, or it's used in an aerosol where you actually vaporize, you know, you put it in this cooker that brings it up to 297 degrees, and it actually vaporizes the cannabinoids in it, where it's easier to inhale. And I think that takes more than what one could imagine, you know, rolling one or putting in a pipe would actually use.
Listeners, we're speaking with John Polonowicz. He's the Massachusetts Secretary for Health and Human Services. We're talking about everything from the implementation of the state's new medical marijuana law. In a few minutes, we'll talk about controlling the spiraling cost of healthcare and other issues. He's the head of the state's the state's largest department in terms of dollars under his purview. $21 billion flows through the Department of Health and Human Services every year. So what's your question for him? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Secretary Polonowicz, a couple more quick questions about medical marijuana. So the ballot initiative that passed allows 35, I believe, dispensaries across Massachusetts with no more than five in each county. But that basically means that when the law is fully implemented, everyone in Massachusetts will be living within a couple towns of a potential dispensary. And there have been communities that have said they don't want them in their community. But Attorney General Coakley said that, I believe she said that towns cannot ban a dispensary outright. So I'm wondering what you would say to residents who do live in those areas of the state that actually would prefer to not have one.
So I think there's two things about it. You're absolutely right. It's 35. We are, by virtue of the ballot initiative, required to have one in each county. So that's at least a minimum of 14 that we would have. As you said, the Attorney General struck down a ban in Wakefield that tried to outright ban the placement of a dispensary in Wakefield. Having said that, there are 50 towns or so, and because they don't have to put this through the Attorney General, who have either enacted or are seeking to enact temporary moratoriums, and the Attorney General has not commented on that. I guess what I would say is, the Department of Public Health in this instance really got it right. They did an unprecedented amount of listening. They looked at what had happened in the 17 other states. I think that they picked something that protects the Commonwealth from diversion and gives the patients that need marijuana access to it. We've also worked very closely with the cities and towns to ensure that they still have the ability to weigh in on where, you know, not only citing, but anything else with respect to how it's going to be cited in their town. And in fact, as a part of the application process, which, as you said, you know, we're in the midst of finalizing, that's a key indicator for us, is whether or not a community has actually signed off on sighting of one of these in their in their town, in their city or town.
So a couple other things that have emerged recently about the implementation includes things like the decision that medical marijuana can be ingested but not in candy-like forms that could be attractive to children, that no neon signs will be allowed in windows of dispensaries. They must look like professional establishments. And that I believe, and please correct me if I'm getting this wrong, because all this, you know, I want to be sure we're 100% accurate, but that youth under 18 will have access to medical marijuana?
So they will, I'll take them hopefully in reverse order. They will have access to medical marijuana as an underage individual here in the Commonwealth, but they need sign-off from at least two physician providers, one of which is a board-certified pediatrician, and their parent to sign off on that. So we had heard very much from the advocates that, young individuals either with debilitating or terminal diseases, terminal, you know, meaning likelihood that less than 2 years, would have access to it. And frankly, our original regulations did not allow it. And I think, and going back, I think we've struck a nice balance between, you know, having the two physicians, one being a board-certified pediatrician, in a bona fide physician relationship with that patient, with the consent of the parent, that it can in fact be dispensed at that point.
Okay, and the other two seem to be practical issues, which I don't know if we need to go into that much detail. No neon signs in the windows of dispensaries. That actually seems to make a lot of sense to
me.
Right. You've mentioned a couple times that the Department of Public Health looked at the other states that have medical marijuana laws in effect, and that leads me to what I think is a pretty important question. That, you know, when you did you do something similar and look across the country, what is it that has happened in other states that, for example, you know, has given you pause or cause for concern that you don't want to repeat here in Massachusetts?
So I would say the thing that is still an unknown for us is what really happens here in Massachusetts from a federal perspective, because obviously it's still against federal law in order to do this. So we had looked at a number of the other states. Some of the other states had, you know, sole massive growers that were providing this, and we looked at that, in some discussions with individuals at the federal level. They thought, they indicated that would be, more kind of sticking their nose in it. So we decided to do, a fully integrated, vertical integrated, something that we can have some control over, something that the department, through its staff can ensure that, there's no pesticides, there's no heavy metals and other things in it. So, my concern is we've opened up and we just won't know the answer for some time. There's questions about individuals in federally funded housing. How does that, if they're smoking medical marijuana or they're ingesting medical marijuana in a federally funded housing, individuals who are federal employees who happen to live here in the state. I think there's enough vagaries out there that we're just going to have to work through each of them as they come up.
I wanted to ask you, though, I think in most of the states where medical marijuana has been legalized, at least 1% of the population has either been administered marijuana or been issued the card. I think in Colorado, which keeps coming up, it's 2%. That's not an insignificant number. Do you think that that we could be seeing rates as high here in Massachusetts, and does that concern you at all?
Well, I think the piece that would really concern me, and we've done our projections based on about 0.5%, and to be perfectly candid, I'm not sure how we got there, but that's the number that we've factored in. The piece that would concern me about the number is, I guess, two things. One, if we're not doing this in the context of really what the intent of the voters had decided, which was to provide this for pain and palliative care in the basis of a physician providing a certification for this. And I think the second, which is a corollary to that, is we want to make sure that we don't have any unintended diversion of this. And I think, as the program got bigger, obviously the opportunity for more diversion exists, which is why, as we're putting an information system in, the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security will have access to that. So whenever someone is picked up stopped, they will have access to this database to ensure right then is the person actually have a card, have a certification card, or are they just saying that they have a card?
So possession under a certain amount in Massachusetts has been decriminalized, mm-hmm. and now we have medical marijuana. Do you think we're on the path to basically de facto legalization of marijuana in the state?
We're seeing that in some of the other states where medical marijuana was the first step, and they've taken the step to decriminalize the all aspects of marijuana. I'm not sure we're there yet in the state. While it passed in every city and town except two, the pass rate was, I think, 67% or something like that. So there's still a large number of people who, even on a medical marijuana side, did not think that this was where we were supposed to go. So, I'm holding out hope, and unfortunately hope is not a strategy, but I am holding out hope that With the rules that we've been able to put in place and in the public comment that we've sought up until now, that we've got a program that will be able to keep a box around this and get the patients that need this have access to it and not have any unintended diversions.
Listeners, I'm speaking with John Polonowicz. He's the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state of Massachusetts. Let's take a quick call. Bill is calling from Reading. You're on the air, Bill.
Hi. The law allowed for a function that was referred to as caregivers, and caregivers were allowed to take care of patients for a while until new regulations were passed on May 24th, which effectively shut down the caregiver function. Many patients who rent or own condos or live in many other circumstances, in fact, probably most patients, can't grow their own marijuana, and there probably won't be any dispensaries for about a year from now. So without caregivers, with the caregiver function having been shut down by the Department of Health, where should patients get their marijuana?
Bill, thank you so much for your call. Secretary Polonowicz?
Oh, thanks for the call, Bill. Actually, the caregivers are not shut down. What we've done here in Massachusetts is we have, as opposed to other states where, in effect, an entire industry was set up in and around caregivers, where a caregiver could be growing for multiple individuals, which also was outside of the control of the dispensaries in those states. What we've determined is that the caregiver can have a one-to-one relationship with a patient. So those patients that are infirm or immobile or don't have access to the dispensaries, as you indicated, I'm not sure it's going to take a year. We're hoping to have the licenses out by the end of the year, and certainly based on some of the things we've heard, there are people that are, ready, willing, and able to go. But you're right, in terms of full access across the state, it's still going to take some time. But that caregiver function is still there. We've just made a determination that we want it to be a one-to-one relationship with that patient so that we don't have caregivers out there setting up, a separate sub-industry around medical marijuana.
Secretary Polonowicz, let's shift gears if we can just for a little bit, because there's obviously another big issue that touches everybody in the Commonwealth, and that is the continuing spiraling upward cost of health care. And you bring a pretty unique perspective to this because you have served in the past as president of St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Brighton. That's the largest hospital in the Steward healthcare system. And, given that experience, and Steward healthcare has been pretty aggressive in trying to implement ways to reduce costs. But in a state like Massachusetts, one of the loudest arguments that we hear frequently comes from the academic medical centers, which are, they're gems for the state of Massachusetts in terms of the medical research and care that comes out of there. But those, high top tier medical centers often say, look, our prices, while they may be higher or are higher than other medical institutions around the state, are so because we need to support the research that goes on there, or we serve a lot of patients who can't fully pay, et cetera. They haven't yet been as willing as others to aggressively make moves to control costs. What do you tell them specifically about the impact they have on prices overall in the Commonwealth?
Right. So I would start by saying, we are one of the few states where we're a little upside down in terms of where care is actually being sought. The vast majority of individuals in other states, are not running to their academic medical centers for primary and secondary care. They're absolutely going there for tertiary care and for some of the advanced and really, frankly, programs that we should be, as a Commonwealth, should be very proud of, that we have them here in Massachusetts. I think that part of the issue is, and what I would say is, we have a lot of duplication of programs. We have programs. Even within some systems, the same program almost across the street from each other. From the Steward experience, I think that there are opportunities for us. And I think I would say, and I've said this to many of my my former healthcare CEO colleagues, that no one is going to want to pay us more for the things that we are doing today. So we have to figure out ways to provide the care less expensive, whether that's through technology, through reduction of testing, through reduction of waste. And then beyond that, I think it's, you know, certainly many organizations are having, and they're doing this now. I think if the Mass Hospital Association was here, that, you know, they would, you know, regale us in how many dollars of cost have been reduced from their organizations throughout the last couple of years. But we need to figure out what businesses we need to be in and whatnot. You know, do we need five of these ultra high level services for the Commonwealth? You know, the problem then becomes...
Well, someone say that we do.
Well, you do. You know, and this is the interesting thing, you know, and I heard it, you know, right after the marathon, you know, because frankly, we've all asked, you know, do we need this many level one trauma, you know?
And on that day, we did.
But so if you need that capacity, the question is, you know, if you can't take it from there, then everything else you do has got to be run, you know, in a very fine way, in as most cost-efficient a way as possible, and looking at, you know, how the organizations are structured, there is opportunities there. It's hard to go after them.
Yeah. We're running out of time here, and this issue of cost control is such an important and complex one that I'm offering you an invitation to come back on the show and talk more about it, because it's an ongoing conversation that I would love more of your input on. But in the last minute or so that we have, the Department of Health and Human Services also oversees a lot of benefits that people get, including food stamps, electronic benefit cards, et cetera. And you, you're taking part in a bit of an experiment, I understand, the SNAP challenge. We've got about a minute for you to describe why you've only got one small glass of water in front of you as part of this challenge.
So the Food Resource and Action Center every year has run a SNAP challenge. Currently 19 members of Congress are doing it. Myself and my family and my commissioner of DTA are doing it. It's to live on what the average SNAP benefit is, which is $4.50 a day or $31.50 a week for all of your meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You can't buy out because a SNAP card can't be used in a restaurant.
And SNAP is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
It is. It's the new food stamps program. Yeah. And so we've been working on it this week. I'm done on Wednesday night.
And how's it been on less than $5 a day?
It's hard. The hard part is trying to figure out how to eat in a nutritious way, which actually ties to our education system, it ties to our public health system. You know, if we're not able to provide, you know, a good nutrition, we are paying those costs in other ways.
Well, John Polonowicz is the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state of Massachusetts. He's former president of St. Elizabeth's Medical Center and also former president of Marlborough Hospital. Secretary Polonowicz, thank you so much for coming in today, and we'll welcome you back hopefully in the near future.
I was thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
And now, A Dose of Kind World, WBUR's online celebration of random acts of kindness with stories submitted by our listeners and readers.
Rick Colson of Watertown left this voicemail for us describing the kindness of his neighbors during one of the most trying times in his life, his wife's battle with cancer.
My wife was diagnosed with environmentally related form of breast cancer many years ago. And she passed away about 2 years ago. And after her diagnosis, it became clear that one of the things that was going to be vital to try and help her keep well was a supply of good quality organic foods. A neighbor from town, during the time that my late wife was ill, came by once a month with the little bag, inside of which was a $500 gift certificate to Whole Foods. I can't even begin to tell you the impact that this had on us. Month after month after month, it allowed her to have the best nutrition that she could find, the organic foods that she needed. And unfortunately, her illness overcame her, and she did ultimately pass away, but I will forever be grateful to the neighbors who did this for us without being asked, entirely on their own, unselfishly. And I only wish that there were more people like them in this world.
And that story was submitted to WBUR's Kind World Project by Rick Colson of Watertown. If you have recently been the beneficiary of a random act of kindness, submit your story to kindworld@wbur.org.
Coming up, from Russian spies to Whitey Bulger to the marathon bombings, a conversation with the outgoing head of the Boston FBI office. He's Richard DeLaurier, and we'll hear from him next. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.